Hello, Radio World. You are listening to Movieland on CITR 101.9 FM with me, your host, Casey. Here in Movieland, I talk about and play you sounds and scenes of films across the spectrum of cinema. And on last week's premiere episode, I presented to you my Christmas side A's, which are my non-secular holy trinity of Christmas movies. Like, if the three wise men had with them film reels instead of frankincense, myrrh, and gold, they'd be taking with them Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, Chris Noonan's Babe, and Yasujiro Ozu's Tokyo Story. Now, a few people I talked to were a bit astounded that Babe made the list, but this list comes not just from a cerebral place, but someplace very guttural. And anyone who listened to last week's episode will know the story behind that. And no, I am not a vegetarian. So today I'm going to continue and wrap up the holidays and 2015 with my side B holiday films. I selected these without thinking much about their relationship to one another, but in my revisitation of these films, I'm pleasantly surprised at how well they work together in terms of genre and tone. Mildred Pierce is a classic film noir starring Joan Crawford, directed by Michael Curtiz, who also directed Casablanca. And Mildred Pierce is a pretty progressive film with fresh post-war feminist potency. Following that will be The Big Lebowski by the Coen brothers from a 1995... It's an existential neo-noir, anti-buddy black comedy for Gen Xers. And Eyes Wide Shut by Stanley Kubrick, released in 1999, which is a psychological noir, the last film by the director who died just a few days after the screening of its final cut. So I'm going to do this chronologically, starting with Mildred Pierce. I'm going to play the trailer, and there are a lot of juicy intertitles in there that don't get spoken, which I will relay to you.
Mildred. Mildred. A name gasped in the night. The one last word of a dying man. But one word that tells a thousand stories of a woman who left her mark on every man she met.
Mildred had more to offer a man in a glance than most women give in a lifetime. Mildred knew what she wanted. It wasn't too particular how she got it. Mildred? Loving her was like shaking hands with the devil.
I wonder why you brought me here tonight.
I mean, all of a sudden, boom. Husband gone, soft lights, quiet room, opportunity.
She tried to kiss off a crime.
You make me feel, I don't know, warm.
And wanted.
How long has this been going on?
Bonnie's going to divorce you and marry me. And there's nothing you can do about it. You think because you've made a little money, you can get yourself a new hairdo and some expensive clothes and turn yourself into a lady. But you can't. Because you'll never be anything but a common...
So, by 1945, film noir is a pretty established genre, with a visual style stemming back to German Expressionism, lots of strong, high-contrast, chiaroscuro lighting, made possible by three-point lighting design of lushly decorated sets of city dwellings, the apartments, cars, smoky bars, alleyways, and back streets of the concrete jungle. In its content, film noir was very much a cinematic continuation of the hard-boiled pulp detective novel genre made famous by Raymond Chandler and James M. McCain, and from gangster films of the 30s. Many European artists fled prior to World War II, and enough working in the film industry made it to Hollywood and brought with them their German expressionist history. German directors like Fritz Lang and Billy Wilder, even Alfred Hitchcock, who came to America pretty early in 1926, attributed his visual style to working for UFA Studios in Germany. So, in 1945, the genre of noir was pretty well on its way with recognizable archetypal characters. A male anti-hero protagonist, a femme fatale, red herrings, wise-talking sidekicks, murder, money, romance, suspense, all enacted in a codified system in order to function under the Hays Production Code, a kind of rules and moral conduct that all movies had to follow from 1930 to 1968. This was like a pre-rating system. Basically, no profanity, no drugs, no sex, no guns, no man and woman in a bed together, no long kisses, etc. Everything one would want to depict in the film noir genre couldn't be. So filmmakers and scriptwriters had to get creative, and audiences had to develop an understanding of wit and innuendo. When a scene ends with an embrace, fades out, and fades back in, you can imagine what happened. I want to play you a scene from The Big Sleep, a noir by Howard Hawks in 1946, based on the Raymond Chandler book, made a year after Mildred Pierce, starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Bogie and Bacall, as the couple was known. It is the most convoluted detective story of them all, I think. And here, Humphrey Bogart's perfect embodiment of Marlowe visits a bookshop during an afternoon rainstorm. Check it out.
Going to wait for him to come out?
Yeah.
It'll close for another hour or so. It's raining pretty hard.
I got my car. That's right, it is, isn't it? You know, it just happens. I got a bottle of pretty good rye in my pocket. I'd a lot rather get wet in here.
Well. Looks like we're closed for the rest of the afternoon. Tell me more about this business.
Oh, there isn't much to tell.
What's the matter?
Just wondering if you have to,
Oh, not necessarily.
Little things like that make it up. Hello.
Hello.
Well, hello. A definite fade to black there. So, back to Mildred Pierce. Mildred Pierce is, like the trailer said, a different kind of story from the typical film noir. It turns its gender roles all upside down and is pretty epic in terms of the timeline. It covers at least 15 years of a woman's life in which she changes her family and her class, whereas all other film noirs I can think of are episodic and occur in shorter time frames. Like the few months it takes to fake a murder, steal someone's identity, and then be caught for it, which under the Hays Production Code had to happen. All evils must be accounted for, all sinners must repent, etc. Mildred is not the femme fatale of the film, but the anti-hero protagonist, while still playing a woman's role most of the time. It's not like she's a private eye solving cases. She is a woman who works her way up becoming a successful business owner by making pies and fried chicken. She is disciplined and smart and tries to be a good mother, but has a hard time seeing her spoiled, cruel-hearted daughter for what she really is until it is too late. Here is another scene from the film, and from the expository nature of the dialogue, there's not much I have to set up except for how the scene looks. It starts off with Vita, Mildred's daughter, lying down on her mother's couch, and she kisses a check for $10,000. Both women are dressed in similar black dresses, and as their conversation escalates, they ascend the staircase.
Well, that's that.
I'm sorry this had to happen. Sorry for the boy. He seemed very nice.
Oh, Ted's all right, really. Did you see the look on his face when we told him he was going to be a father?
I wish you wouldn't joke about it.
Mother, you're a scream. Really, you are. The next thing I know, you'll be knitting little garments.
I don't see anything so ridiculous about that.
If I were you, I'd save myself the trouble.
You're not going to have a baby?
At this stage, it's a matter of opinion. And in my opinion, I'm going to have a baby. I can always be mistaken.
How could you do such a thing? How could you?
I got the money, didn't I?
Oh, I see.
I'll have to give Wally part of it to keep him quiet, but there's enough left for me.
Money. That's what you live for, isn't it? You'd do anything for money, wouldn't you? Even blackmail.
Oh, grow up.
I've never denied you anything. Anything money could buy, I've given you. But that wasn't enough, was it? All right, Vita, from now on, things are going to be different.
I'll say they're going to be different. Why do you think I went to all this trouble? Why do you think I want money so badly?
All right, why?
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
Then I'll tell you. With this money, I can get away from you.
Vita.
From you and your chickens and your pies and your kitchens and everything that smells of grease. I can get away from this shack with its cheap furniture and this town and its dollar days and its women that wear uniforms and its men that wear overalls.
Vita, I think I'm really seeing you for the first time in my life, and you're cheap and horrible.
You think just because you made a little money, you can get a new hairdo and some expensive clothes and turn yourself into a lady. But you can't, because you'll never be anything but a common frump whose father lived over a grocery store and whose mother took in washing. With this money, I can get away from every rotten, stinking thing that makes me think of this place or you. Vita! Not on your life!
I said give it to me! Get out, Vita. Get your things out of this house right now before I throw them into the street and you wet them.
Wow, cheap and horrible, as the mother says. And as you can see or hear, film noir, especially this film noir, has the roots of melodrama and, for better or worse, the soap opera. The way the camera follows the faces of the actors and the heightened, emotionally explosive dialogue happening amidst orchestral cues are super effective in creating a seamless verisimilitude that envelops the spectator in their seat. Like a lot of noirs, the story is told in flashback. Mildred is in custody telling her story to the police. And it's interesting to note that her retelling of her life is not so noirish as the police's inquiry into it. Her life, the melodrama of her story, fits into the noir framing of the film. To me, this is an example of subversion, an infiltration of a dominant system to change it from within. And it's a very complex series of events that happens over 15 years, through which Mildred has one ambition, to make her daughter love her. And she tries to do this in all the ways. She becomes a successful entrepreneur, she showers Vita with everything she wants, she gets married, she turns a blind eye to Vita's exploits, she tries to fix them. A bit later in the film, Mildred's ex-husband takes her out to dinner, and they wind up here.
I never did like this place. Does Wally still own it?
Yeah. Two-room Collins, please.
Yes, sir.
Still don't know why you insisted on coming here.
I thought it was a good idea at the time. Now I'm not so sure.
Billy McCoy was a musical boy on the cruiser Alabama. He was there on that piano like a fish down in the sea. When he rattled off some harmony, every night down on the ocean, he would get that raggy notion, start that syncopated rhythm lovingly. No one could sleep well there on the deep when Billy cut loose out.
I'm sorry I did it like this, Mildred, but I didn't know how to tell you.
Fish and worm begins to twist and squirm. The ship starts into dipping, there's a corkscrew turn. Now when the hammock starts a-swinging and the bell begins a-ringing, while he's sitting at that piano there on the Alabama, playing that Oceana roll.
Mildred.
Hello, Wally. Charlie.
Hello, Mildred. Where to see me?
I'm going to take Vita home.
Yeah? Vita know about that?
No. I want you to help me, Walter.
Oh, not me. She's your daughter. I've never been a father. But Vita's been here for about a month now, Mildred, and I think I know the best way to handle her. Let me give you a little advice. If you want her to do anything for you, just hit her in the head first.
Vita, played by Anne Blythe, is a great singer. I love it when movies have live musical performances by the actors themselves. Rita Hayworth has a lot of great ones where she sings, strums the guitar, and dances. Lauren Bacall sings beside a piano. Ingmar Bergman does too. Lana Turner was an amazing dancer. Old movie stars definitely exercised more of that versatility back in the golden age of old Hollywood. So HBO did a Mildred Pierce miniseries with Kate Winslet, Guy Pierce, and Evan Rachel Wood, directed by Todd Haynes a few years ago. And I remember it being okay. It was a very Haynesian adaptation of the classic film, which was, I guess, based on the novel, which I think Todd Haynes was maybe being more true to. Like, Joan Crawford's a diva, and she was portrayed in diva fashion as, like, a martyr, a saint, untouchable. Whereas in Todd Haynes' miniseries, you see everybody's motivations more. And it's not so much about a noir with this reverse Oedipal clash between the mother, her lover, and her daughter. It's much, much more human and psychological in that everyone's kind of guilty of being selfish and shady and cruel. And it's in color, which is just too much melodrama. Haynes is no Douglas Sirk, and an HBO miniseries is just not as satisfying as a film. But I will say that it has the best choking scene I've ever seen between a mother and a daughter. I'm going to leave Mildred Pierce now, and I'll leave you with Sonic Youth's eponymously titled song.
Thank you. Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
A stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
For over 30 years, there has been one voice in the local Vancouver art scene that has stood above the rest, and that's Discorder, that conspiracy, punk rock, foxcore, sassy, still publishing magazine from CITR. We're one of the established and trusted voices of Vancouver's music and arts culture in the Lower Mainland, with 8,000 copies distributed monthly to over 135 distribution locations, from the Lido to Zulu Records.
Discorder is one of a few magazines published by a community radio station, and we only serve up the freshest local and Canadian goods.
We have interviews with artists, album reviews, live show reviews, and articles about everything important to our crazy, unique, varied, and amazing culture in Vancouver and across the country.
Pick up your free copy of Discorder today, or sign up to have it delivered to your door wherever you are.
Check out our website for distribution locations and all the information about advertising and getting involved with Discorder.
Welcome back to Movieland on CRTR 101.9 FM. I'm Casey, and today I'll be taking us through my holiday side B movies, which are the films I think are best experienced during... the joyous chaos of the holiday season. Moving on from Michael Curtis's 1945 feminist noir classic, Mildred Pierce, my next choice is The Big Lebowski by the Coen brothers. And here is the opening scene.
Tumbling down, pledging their love to the ground.
Way out west, there was this fella I want to tell you about. Fella by the name of Jeff Lebowski. At least that was the handle his loving parents gave him. But he never had much use for it himself. This Lebowski, he called himself the Dude. Now, Dude. That's a name no one would self-apply where I come from. But then there was a lot about the dude that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And a lot about where he lived, likewise. But then again, maybe that's why I found the place so darn interesting. They call Los Angeles the City of Angels. I didn't find it to be that exactly. But I'll allow there are some nice folks there. Of course, I can't say I've seen London. And I've never been to France. And I ain't never seen no queen in her damned undies, as the fella says. But I'll tell you what. After seeing Los Angeles, and this here story I'm about to unfold, I guess I've seen something every bit as stupefying as you'd see in any of those other places. And in English, too. So I can die with a smile on my face without feeling like the good Lord gypped me. Now, this here story I'm about to unfold took place back in the early 90s, just about the time of our conflict with Saddam and the Iraqis. I only mention it because sometimes there's a man, I won't say a hero, 'cause what's a hero? But sometimes there's a man, and I'm talking about the dude here. Sometimes there's a man, well, he's the man for his time and place. He fits right in there. And that's the dude in Los Angeles. And even if he's a lazy man, and the dude was most certainly that, quite possibly the laziest in Los Angeles County, which would place him high in the running for laziest worldwide. But sometimes there's a man. Sometimes there's a man. Ah, lost my train of thought here. But, ah, hell, I done introduced him enough.
With them all for collective action, this will not stand. This will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait.
Here on the range I belong, drifting along with the tumbling, tumbleweed.
Sometimes there's a man. There are so many quotable lines from The Big Lebowski, and as a teenager, I learned words I had not yet known, like micturate, fatuous, paraquat. And I still find myself texting, "That's just like your opinion, man," every now and then. I've seen this movie many times, and each time I love it more. I am able to embrace its flow more as I get older. Movies like this are pretty rare. Like, what is it even about, really? This film is a perfect example of how the narrative is a device for the art to come through, which is in itself an art. And at the end of the film, the art still eludes me. I know it's there, but to locate what it is and how it is and what it means is still pretty impossible. Like, to do so would be going against the point of the film, which I think has a lot to do with chaos, and as the German thugs insist, nihilism. It is a classically convoluted film noir plot, bookended by the soothing, omnipotent narrator, the stranger, the romantic cowboy who has seen it all, who we hear narrating the intro and is retelling the story of a time in the dude's life, which happens to be a frenzied, confusing, surreal case of mistaken identity, kidnapping, and fraud, that is being retold by a figure watching from the outside, a visitor to Los Angeles, sitting in the bowling alley where the dude and his two friends, Walter and Donnie, play league bowling. The bowling alley is where the stranger overhears the events of the narrative, and on a couple of occasions interacts with the dude, so it's plausible enough that he knows what's going on and can retell the story, again like in Mildred Pierce, in flashback. I really like the dichotomy of the dude and the stranger. I think of that difference in the same way as I think about movies and films. Same thing, different context. The dude is basically the aging hippie version of the cowboy archetype. He is a rebel, a hero, but like 90s slackers, the dude is spiritualized and educated. He's a total stoner, and the bowling alley is his holy place. When he needs to distress, he lies down on his apartment floor with his headphones in, listening to tapes of the perfect game, just the sounds of strikes as soothing to him as the sound of the ocean. And with his fingers, he follows through a little bit with the strike in his imagination and a small smile on his face. Although he is lazy and unemployed, the dude is a natural sponge for words, information, and clues, but the only ambition driving him through the film is to get compensation for his rug.
Okay, sir, you're a Lebowski, I'm a Lebowski. That's terrific. But I am very busy, as I imagine you are. What can I do for you, sir?
Well, sir, it's this rug I have. It really tied the room together.
You told Brad on the phone, he told me. Where do I fit in?
Well, they were looking for you, these two guys. I'll say it again.
You told Brad on the phone, he told me. I know what happened, yes, yes.
Oh, so you know that they were trying to piss on your rug.
Did I urinate on your rug?
You mean, did you personally come and pee on my rug?
Hello! You speak English, sir? Parla usted inglés? I'll ask you again. Did I urinate on your rug?
No, like I said, woo peed on my rug.
I just want to understand this, sir. Every time a rug is micturated upon in this fair city. I have to compensate the person.
Come on, man. I'm not trying to scam anybody here.
You're just looking for a handout like every other. Are you employed, Mr. Lebowski?
Let me explain something to you. I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? His dudeness or duder or, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
Are you employed, sir?
Employed?
You don't go out looking for a job dressed like that, do you? On a weekday?
Is this a... What day is this?
Well, I do work, sir. So if you don't mind...
No, I do mind. The dude minds. This will not stand, you know? This aggression will not stand, man. I mean, your wife owes
me... My wife is not the issue here. I hope that someday my wife will learn to live on her allowance, which is ample. But if she does not, that is her problem, not mine. Just as the rug is your problem. Just as every bum's lot in life is his own responsibility, regardless of who he chooses to blame. I didn't blame anyone for the loss of my legs. Some Chinaman took them from me in Korea, but I went out and achieved anyway. I cannot solve your problem, sir. Only you can.
So the dude gets mixed up in a case of mistaken identity and a kidnapping. Some dumb, like Zoolander dumb thugs mistake him for a much wealthier Lebowski and piss on his rug. The dude goes over to Lebowski's mansion, hoping for some compensation, is turned away, but not before he meets Lebowski's beautiful young wife, Bunny. Bunny gets kidnapped, Lebowski hires the dude to drop off the ransom money, and that doesn't go off as planned, obviously, and here is where the narrative really starts to open up and get wild. My favorite scene is when the dude visits Jackie Treehorn's mansion by the beach during a sexy bonfire party. Jackie and the dude have a conversation about Bunny and the missing money. Jackie's a porn tycoon. Bunny starred in some of his films. And at one point, he goes to answer his phone. And the dude watches him from where he's sitting, scribble something on a piece of paper, rip it off the pad, excuses himself for a second, and walks out of the room. The moment Jackie leaves, the dude jumps up from his seat like a jungle cat to the notepad, and with a pencil quickly shades the blank piece of paper for the negative image. Classic film noir trope, but instead of information, a phone number, a name... The dude gets a negative relief doodle of a man with an erection. That scene encapsulates the movie perfectly for me. It's a wild goose chase. It's a farce. It's a carnival. And for all its nihilist runarounds, it's a very smart portrayal of American politics. That's something I can't just ignore in the reading of the film. I'm all for, like, running around these MacGuffins that go nowhere. But there's something very insistent on the Coen brothers' repeated saturation of the film with politics that I feel like it's there from the very beginning. There's intent with George Bush's address in Kuwait playing on TV while the dude pays for his half and half with a check that is dated September 11th, which is kind of a strange coincidence, right? And this happens while the stranger introduces Hussein and Bush into our periphery, the political climate of the time. And throughout the film, we are repeatedly assaulted with Walter's hot-headed, macho, self-righteous, hypocritical, neoconservative opinions. And somehow the two, Walter and the dude, remain best buds. And one of the few facts we learn about the dude's history is that he helped draft the Port Huron Statement that founded the Students for a Democratic Society in the 60s and was a member of the Seattle Seven. Students for a Democratic Society advocated participatory democracy, where constituents wielded power as opposed to an elective representative. And the Seattle Seven were the most famous members of the Seattle Liberation Front, an anti-war organization during the Vietnam era, just as the SDS was dissolving. So the film sneaks this very specific historical information into all its fun chaos, and through it presents some very light and subtle political signifiers. This film has the aging hippie and the angry neocon as best friends, both quite disenfranchised and broke, along with their third, much more demure and almost invisible sidekick, Donnie. The three of them are a family unit of sorts, those men who grew up post-Vietnam, post-Woodstock, to inherit their freedoms. Excuse the bleeps of the next scene.
I'm throwing rocks tonight. Mark it, dude.
This was a valued rock.
This was a...
Yeah, man, it really tied the room together.
This was a value, dog.
Yeah. Tied the room together, dude?
My rug.
Were you listening to the dude's story, Donnie?
Walter.
Were you listening to the dude's story?
I was bowling.
So you have no frame of reference here, Donnie. You're like a child who wanders into the middle of a movie and wants to know.
Walter, what's the point, man?
There's no reason. Here's my point, dude. There's no fucking reason why these...
Yeah, Walter, what's your point?
Huh?
Walter, what is the point? Look. We all know who is at fault here. What the fuck are you talking about?
Huh? No, what the fuck are you... I'm not... We're talking about unchecked aggression here.
What the fuck is he talking
my
about?
My rug.
Forget it, Donnie. You're out of your element.
Walter, the Chinaman who peed on my rug, I can't go give him a bill. So what the fuck are you talking about?
What the fuck are you talking about? The Chinaman is not the issue here, dude. I'm talking about drawing a line in the sand, dude. Across this line, you do not... Also, dude... Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Walter, this isn't a guy who built the railroads here. This is a guy...
What the fuck are you...
Walter, he peed on my rug.
He peed on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element. Dude, the Chinaman is not the issue here.
So who?
Jeff Lebowski, the other Jeffrey Lebowski, the millionaire.
That's fucking interesting, man. That's fucking interesting.
Plus, he has the wealth. Obviously, and the resources, so that there's no fucking reason why his wife should go out and owe money all over town, and then they come and they pee on your fucking rug. Am I wrong?
No.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, but...
Okay, then. That rug really tied the room together, did it not?
There's a supercut of all the swears in the Big Lebowski on YouTube, and it is pretty funny. The F word is used 260 times, which is nothing compared to the most, that being the Wolf of Wall Street. And I think I read it has like the F word in there 593 times. But the swears in The Big Lebowski are more quotable. Like half the time they're just repeating each other anyway. There are some really great performances by a then relatively unfamous Philip Seymour Hoffman. Julianne Moore plays Maude Lebowski. Tara Reid plays Bunny. John Turturro as Jesus was on a different level of repulsive and so funny. Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers is in it as a nihilist. Ben Gazzara, I think his name is Jackie Treehorn, the porn tycoon. Some really good acting. And back to the film itself, it's a real question mark of a film. It runs around itself, but at a calm pace. And maybe that's the stranger's presence keeping us at ease. I don't know. Like, I was never stressed out while watching the film, despite all the suspense cues it takes from film noir and all of Walter's outbursts. It was so deeply funny, like seriously funny, and paced so well. And I will finish The Big Lebowski with the dream sequence the dude has after he is drugged. The sequence is its own mini film, a Jackie Treehorn production. Called Gutterballs, starring the dude and Maude Lebowski, featuring the song Just Dropped In by Kenny Rogers.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah.
My condition was in. I pushed my soul in a deep dark hole and then I followed it in. I watched myself crawling out as I was crawling in. I got up so tight I couldn't unwind. I saw so much. I broke my mind. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. I
black letters on a dead end sign. I had my foot on the gas as I left the road and blew out my mind. 8 miles out of Memphis and I got no spare. 8 miles straight up downtown somewhere. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. I said I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants? What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
Hello, this is the recording artist Jay Arner, and you're listening to CITR. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back to Movie Land on CITR 101.9 FM. Casey here, and I'm just wrapping up my 3 holiday side B films. This is episode 2 of Movie Land. It's the end of 2015, and I thought it would be a nice way to ease into the show by sharing my Christmas picks. Last week, I talked about The Shining, Babe, and Tokyo Story, the top 3 films I'd watch on Christmas Day, my side A, I suppose. And so far today, I've talked about Mildred Pierce and The Big Lebowski on my side B. And I'm going to end the selection by going back to the same director I started with, Stanley Kubrick, and the last film he made, Eyes Wide Shut, in 1999 with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. The film was an adaptation of a 1926 short story called Trame Nouvelle, a French for dream story. For those of you who are born in the new millennium and think of Tom and Nicole as old, irrelevant movie stars, let me tell you how big they were in the 1990s. They were the it couple, like Brangelina, like Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake, like Bogey and Bacall of the 90s. And to work with a director as revered as Stanley Kubrick would have been the chance for those Hollywood stars to prove to the serious film scholars, critics, and fans outside of the American Hollywood tabloid bubble their commitment to the art of acting and filmmaking, as opposed to what they were more commonly known for, which was their celebrity couple gossip-generating power. Todd Field, who plays Nick Nightingale, the pianist who clues Bill, Tom Cruise's character, onto the crazy sex party, says in a 2006 interview, revisiting the film 15 years after its release, he says, "You've never seen two actors more completely subservient and prostrate themselves at the feet of a director."
Isn't it on the bedside table?
Now listen, you know we're running a little late.
I know. How do I look?
Perfect.
Is my hair okay?
It's great.
I'm not even looking at it.
It's beautiful. You're always beautiful.
Did you give Roz the phone and pager numbers?
Yeah, I put it on the fridge. Let's go, huh?
Good. All right. I'm ready.
So that was the second waltz playing in the opening scene of the film, written by Dmitri Shostakovich in 1938 for the Suite for Jazz Orchestra No. 2. And in Eyes Wide Shut, there's a lot of life feeding and bleeding into art. The setup is Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman play Bill and Alice, a kind of yuppie power couple in Manhattan. Bill is a doctor to high society, and Alice used to manage an art gallery in Soho that fell under, and is currently a stay-at-home mother, it seems, to their young daughter. The film starts off with them attending a really fancy Christmas party to one of Bill's wealthy clients, Ziegler, where both Bill and Alice are propositioned by members of the opposite sex. Nothing happens, the two go home and smoke some pot. While they get stoned, Alice reveals that she was jealous of these two models Bill was talking to at the party, and she tells him about a time she fantasized about throwing her whole life away just to have an affair with some random naval officer who walked by them once in a hotel. This mentally crushes Bill, and for the rest of the film, we follow him as he tries to explore extramarital encounters, tries to play detective, tries to rebuild his identity after being emasculated by Alice's revelation. At one point on Bill's odyssey, his jazz pianist friend, Nick, an old med school colleague, discloses to him a secret masquerade sex party, and Bill crashes it in disguise. All he has to do is wear a mask. But he gets caught and is made to reveal his identity in front of all the guests. It's a very freaky scene that is sandwiched between other freaky scenes of people getting freaky. And all the guests are in dark, full-bodied cloaks and carnivalesque Venetian masks, watching Bill's intense fear slightly bubble through the calm veneer of an otherwise very level, very wooden, but I think purposefully so, impassive performance throughout the film. They let him leave, but not before a masked woman vouches for him and takes responsibility for him being there. If it weren't for her, you get a feeling that he wouldn't have left the party unviolated. And the next morning, he tries to track down his pianist friend, is unable to, and begins to believe that he's become entangled in some dark, twisted underworld of sex, drugs, and murder, and feels, you know, morally responsible for the woman who saved his life.
Password, please.
Fidelio.
That's right, sir. That is the password for admittance. But may I ask, what is the password for the house?
The password for the house.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I seem to have forgotten it.
That's unfortunate. Because here, it doesn't matter whether you have forgotten it, or if you never knew it, you will kindly remove your mask.
Last week, I talked about The Shining, and in revisiting it along with Eyes Wide Shut, I noticed several repetitions. The tracking shots of Danny in The Shining and the ones in Eyes Wide Shut as characters are followed through the hallways, the ballroom of the Overlook Hotel and the ballroom of Ziegler's Christmas party, the short scenes of masked depravity that aren't really explained and are left a bit mysterious, and the opulence of public display versus a modest, almost impoverished domestic space. And finally, the representation of madness, which is not so far off from fantasy. These are all reoccurring themes in these two films that I never noticed before. Jack's madness is obvious, but Bill's is very much contained. It's very subtle, and it's quite different. And we can play psychoanalyst here. So he is possibly breaking up with his wife, who he appears to love quite simply, and has possibly stumbled into a dangerous underworld in an attempt to regain something that he had lost. The man is very, very scared, and that fear has manifested itself into a quest to be someone different, to play someone different, as symbolized by the mask. Now, the discovery of the darkness that lies in the mundane, seemingly perfect family unit, and the return to that deflated, perfect narrative after an empty vessel of an experience is more brutal than a ghost story. It's heavy and it's real, and there's really no escape from the hole that is staring him in the face. But there is resolution, and I'm not going to spoil it completely, but the closing scene was so surprising to me the first time I saw it. For a lot of people, this isn't Stanley Kubrick's best film, but I really, really love it. I have no problem with the pacing. I thought it meandered in the right ways, like the meandering narrative of Domino the prostitute and the whole rainbow costume segue, the short, tight fades, like as if it was a TV show, and most of all, I love the lighting. It was just so warm and soft and emotive. The Christmas lights, the beautiful blues in the same frame as the yellows from a different room, the soft haze of the ballroom, the brightly illuminated Manhattan streets at night, the rich sepias and the dark, saturated hues of the sex party followed by the cold grays of the exterior daylight. There's a lot of information on the cinematography about film pushing and lenses that's out there if you care to look. And I'm going to leave you with a couple of songs from the soundtrack. This first one is If I Had You by Roy Gerson. It's a light jazzy romp, followed by I Want a Boy for Christmas by the Del Vets. So that's it for Movieland 2015. I made a Tumblr for it, where you'll soon be able to stream old episodes and more. And it's called movieland.tumblr.com. So check it out and have a happy new year. Next time I'll be back to talk about Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight and other things too. Bye for now. Thank you.
just one present bring to me.
I want a boy for Christmas. I put him underneath my Christmas tree. I want